This is the Financial Sense News Hour. Now, here's the Financial Sense News Team, Jim Poplava and John Loeffler.
Welcome back to the Financial Sense News Hour, the part of the program we call the Big Picture, where we try to unravel the dots and data points that you see out there and explain them for you. Jim Poplava, John Loeffler here with you. You know, ever since January, everybody sort of assumed that the year was going to be another year like the previous 2 years, and we were just going to putter along in happy bliss. But ever since then, the stock market has been unable to sustain a rally, which really surprises a lot of people, because if you look at the fundamentals, they would be dictating that you could. Earnings are accelerating up 24%. GDP growth is picking up. Government stimulus accelerating with tax cuts and spending increases. And unemployment is at record lows, with jobs very easy and plentiful to find out there. And so the real question remains, Jim, why is it that stocks have done nothing but go sideways, up 1 week and down the next? It seems like a reluctance to go anywhere except to just stay right where they are.
You know, John, I think if you were looking at why this is happening, there probably isn't just one reason. Well, there's a main reason. We'll get to that. But let's talk about a number of factors that are weighing in on the market. Number one is we've gone from quantitative easing to quantitative tightening, as Gary Dorsch talked about in hour one. $460 billion worth of bonds will shrink from the Fed's balance sheet, over $600 billion next year. So the Fed is shrinking liquidity in the market. Number two, the Fed is raising interest rates, and long-term interest rates are rising. And along with rising rates, we are now seeing a rising dollar. And we'll talk about the implications for that in a moment. And on top of that, as we discussed in detail last week, and we'll touch upon it again this week, rising oil prices. We are now over $70 a barrel. They're talking about 80. And I read an article today, what happens if it goes to 100? Then, of course, along with all of these factors, we have rising inflation. So what's keeping stock afloat, as we talked about with the interview with Gary Dorsch, is record stock buybacks. Almost $160 billion in the first quarter. It's estimated that buybacks this year could be anywhere from $600 to $800 billion. Now, remember, one company alone, Apple, is going to buy back $100 billion of its stock. And that's just one company. So stock buybacks. And if you look at what has happened with companies, whether it's stock buybacks or it's dividend increases, companies have returned over $1 trillion to shareholders over the last 12 months. So this is what is holding the market up. But a lot of the things I just talked about, quantitative tightening, rising interest rates, rising dollar, rising oil prices, and rising inflation are weighing on the market. I would suspect, John, if you took out the $160 billion of stock buybacks and also mergers, meaning the number of companies on the exchange are shrinking, that the stock market would probably be lower than where it is today.
So what is causing the volatility then? Because let's face it, it was calm for a long time, but now we're seeing all of these spikes in the midst of all the volatility.
I think if you were to sum it up in two factors, they would be Fed tightening and second, rising oil prices. And I would say the main factor is the Fed itself, which is tightening on two fronts. And this is something that they've never done before. We've always seen them raise the Fed funds rate in past cycles when they thought the economy was overheating. But obviously, the economy is not overheating. We're not experiencing 4, 5, 6% economic growth, nor are we experiencing 5 or 6% inflation rates as we were leading into the financial crisis in 2008. But remember, back then, we had rising commodity prices, and in the summer of 2008, oil prices hit $150 a barrel. So this is already leading to turbulence, and where it's being felt, a topic we covered last week, where I think the next crisis will emerge, is in the emerging markets, a subject that we covered extensively last week. But there are signs that this emerging market crisis is beginning to accelerate. We saw this week the country of Argentina is seeking loans from the IMF. Anywhere from $30 to $50 billion as credit tightens. Much of Argentine's loans are denominated in dollars. Turkey's central bank is raising interest rates as the lira crashes. We've seen numerous stories, including more this week, on Venezuela's economy is essentially collapsing and creditors are seizing assets. They're having a problem because as they try to ship oil out on these tankers, many of the destinations these tankers are going to, the creditors are seizing the tankers. And so Venezuela had to call back some of its tankers this week because the creditors want access because Venezuela isn't paying its debts. And international trade is weakening. We're seeing this in a slowdown in China. Japan just experienced its first quarter of contraction. So after almost 26 months of expansion, now we're seeing a contraction. South Korea and Germany's economy is also slowing. So as we concluded in a big picture piece we did last week, an emerging crisis is coming. The question is no longer if, the question is when. And a lot of that's going to depend on what the Fed continues to do and in terms of what happens to the dollar.
You know, I know Gary Dorsch has mentioned that several of the emerging markets are starting to fall. Is this just kind of a harbinger of coming earthquakes?
Well, I mean, if you take a look at some of the emerging markets, they're down 12 to 14%. And even more so, you're seeing signs of this if you look in the currency market where a lot of this trouble is brewing. The Turkish lira, the Argentine peso, I mean, the Turkish lira has lost over 60% of its value since 2014. If you're looking at the Argentine peso, it is collapsing against the dollar, losing almost 80% of its value in the last 4 years. Now, why this is important is there's $3 trillion of emerging market debt that is denominated in U.S. dollars. So not only do you have the dollar going up, but the currencies of these countries are collapsing. So let's put it this way. If you have, let's say Argentina went out and issued a bond for $1 million in U.S. dollars, they have to pay that bond back plus interest. What do you do when you're trying to pay it back when your own currency is down 80%. And that's why you're going to see this crisis come. You're seeing it in the currency markets and central banks are trying to fight this off. In Turkey, they keep raising interest rates. Likewise, in Argentina, this week, Argentina had to reach out to the IMF. They're looking for $30 to $50 billion of a credit infusion into the country. So as we warned last week on the program, it's just a matter of when.
You know, here's the question. Doesn't the Fed realize that its tightening is leading us right into another crisis going opposite of where the tax relief and other things are going?
You know, apparently not. It reminds me in the last decade, just before the financial crisis, I can remember an interview Fed chairman at the time, Ben Bernanke, gave, and they asked him about the real estate market, which was the epicenter of the crisis. He says, real estate's not a problem, should do well. Real estate always does well. Well, we know that wasn't the case. Real estate prices lost nearly 40%, and we had to have a government rescue in the trillions of dollars to bail out banks with all those bogus mortgages. And recently, Chairman Powell gave a speech on the topic of emerging market turmoil and currencies and didn't seem to matter to the Fed. In other words, the Fed right now is focused on what they're seeing happen in the U.S. What are they seeing? They just saw massive stimulus with tax cuts. Then Congress increased spending by $300 billion. And they're also seeing rising oil prices and inflation start to tick up, meeting the Fed's own target of 2%. So they seem oblivious in terms of what they are doing and the impact that it has on markets worldwide. I think that could change when we get into the second half of the year, especially if we get an EM crisis, as I am expecting to see. I mean, right now, there's $3 trillion in U.S. denominated debt in developing countries. So as we look at this, as the Fed tightens, you're seeing the dollar strengthen. Those bonds are going to become more costly, and you're going to see the risk of default. It's not just Venezuela where creditors are seizing oil tankers. in refineries. You're seeing Argentina go to the IMF. And so this is a factor that the more the Fed tightens and spreads widen between interest rates here and an economy that's doing better here as a result of stimulus compared to the rest of the world, which is now beginning to slow down. And many of these currencies are not only falling, but also the interest rate spreads. I mean, the spread between a 10-year treasury and a 10-year German Bund is almost 2.5%. So this only strengthens the dollar and makes the matters worse for the emerging markets.
What accounts for the dollar being strong right now? It wasn't last year.
I think it's the Fed is getting more aggressive. Last year was the first time the Fed raised interest rates 3 times. Now they're talking not only that they're going to raise 3 times, but odds are over 50% that they raise 4 times, raising in June, which is 100% probability, almost a 90% probability in September, and over 50% probability in December. So all of this is strengthening the dollar. In the meantime, interest rates on the short term are negative still in Europe and Japan, and rates in the spreads between what you can get on safe treasuries in the U.S. compared to sovereigns elsewhere. John, it's a chasm as wide as the Grand Canyon.
So if we have to try to explain what this is all about or what this means for investors, here's a clip from MarketWatch that tries to do just that.
The yield on the 10-year Treasury note rose above 3% on Tuesday, its highest level since January 2014. The main force behind the rising yields is growing speculation that the Federal Reserve will be more aggressive in lifting interest rates. Yields started heading higher after a number of Fed officials rekindled the idea that the central bank could raise interest rates 4 times in 2018 and not the 3 times previously expected. Anytime interest rates rise, it can have a significant effect on the economy and on your finances. When the Fed announces a federal funds rate hike, that means that it increases how much banks will be charged to borrow money from other banks. The rate increase eventually trickles down to consumers, and it can affect your credit card debt, your savings account, and even your mortgage. Credit card interest rates are variable, and they're tied to what is known as the prime rate. The prime rate is an index that's just a few percentage points above the federal funds rate. So when the Fed raises the Fed funds rate, the prime rate also goes up, and up goes your credit card interest rate as well. The kicker? Banks don't need your consent to make that change. They'd probably just hit you with a higher rate within the next 2 billing cycles. The average American household is paying around $1,300 in credit card interest every year. So check with your credit card company. You'll want to know if your interest rate is on the rise. Second, it's not all bad because the rate hike means your savings could actually grow. So far, savings rates have not really increased in most banks, but they should increase slightly as overall savings rates are at historical lows. To get the most benefit, consider switching to an online-only bank where savings accounts often have a higher return. Third, for homeowners, it's a completely different story. When the Fed raises rates, variable mortgage rates also rise. So if you have a variable interest rate on your mortgage, be prepared to pay more every month. On the other hand, if you have a fixed rate mortgage, you won't see any changes. But there's a catch. If you were hoping to refinance, you actually just missed out on good savings. Now that the Fed has raised rates, you can no longer lock in that low rate that you were hoping for. So while the Fed rate hike is not all bad news, make sure you read the fine print.
So just as she was explaining in that audio, rising interest rates are going to impact borrowers from consumers to corporations to sovereigns, as we're seeing right now in the emerging market with sovereign debt. And the other thing that she mentioned there, the era of cheap mortgages is over. In fact, mortgage rates this week alone hit a 7-year high, jumping over 4.5% and hitting a 4.6% rate. Many expect that mortgage rates will be over 5% as we get towards the end of the year, as the Fed continues to tighten and shrink liquidity by basically not rolling over a lot of its bonds. So if you add this all up, John, Fed rate hikes, quantitative easing is starting to produce storm fronts around the globe, and we're seeing a glimpse of that not only in the foreign currency markets, but in emerging markets themselves, not only in their sovereign debt, their currencies, but also in the bond markets as well.
But you know, Jim, you can't deny that a lot of our techs here and guests we've had on the FS Insider program during the week, they're getting more cautious, you know. So that's the old expression about continue dancing, but you may want to slip over towards the exit. What should we be doing at this time?
Well, I mean, if you look at traditional advice that's used in this industry, the industry goes by what we call the 60-40 rule, about 60% in stocks and 40% in bonds. Now, the theory behind this, which has worked for almost 4 or 5 decades, is that when stocks go down, bonds rally. And that certainly has been the case the last 9 years of this bull market up until January of this year, when you saw stock downturns, for example, in 2011. You saw that the bond market rallied. When you saw problems in the stock market in 2014, 2015, and 2016, what happened? Treasuries rallied. Well, we got a 12% correction in the stock market from January and the first week of February. This time, bonds did not rally. So normally, this relationship, which has been out there and has existed for almost 30 years, is not working. And here's the problem. So many of the asset allocation models are based on this relationship. And let me just give you an example. In the past, let's say you were in stock funds and you were in, I don't know, it could have been corporate bonds, could have been treasuries, or even junk bonds. And well, junk bonds are really more tied to what goes on in the stock market. So let's just stick with corporate and treasuries. Normally in the past, when the stock market went down, the value of treasuries and corporate bonds would go up. And you can see this on any stock chart program. It's not working. You know, we just use the popular ETFs like TLT. The price of those shares have dropped from 127 down to 117. LQD, which is corporate bonds, have dropped from 120 to 114. And if you look at emerging market bond ETFs, they have gotten down as well. It dropped from 115 down to 108. So, you know, this is one of the things that you're going to have to think differently now. So using bonds as a hedge against falling stocks is no longer working as a hedge. And there's a number of reasons I think that's the case. And there's three of them. One is we're starting from a low base. Remember, in the summer of 2016, bond yields got down to roughly about almost 1.3%. Two, we are entering an era of trillion-dollar deficits. At the same time, number three, the big buyers of U.S. Treasuries, the Fed, the Bank of China, and the Bank of Japan are withdrawing, and actually Japan has been selling off some of its treasuries. So you've got more debt coming to the market. You've got the biggest buyers of that debt withdrawing or cutting back on their buying. And once again, it's just numerical. You start from a base of 1.3, 1.6. I mean, think about it. We were at nearly 1.6 in 2016, and here we are 2 years later, we're over 3%. Interest rates have doubled in a period of 2 years. And so the problem for investors who are trying to hedge is much of the financial industry is based on the stock and bond reverse correlation in their asset allocation mix, but it's not working, John.
No, it isn't. And, you know, since you believe that this isn't going to work in the next downturn, how do you hedge against this event when you see it coming?
You know, I think this time around, you're going to have to think outside the box and think differently. This asset allocation that we've been talking about, the 60-40 split, isn't working. If you're in 60-40 right now, your stock funds are probably down, your bond funds are probably down, so it's not working. And so there is some good news. And part of that good news is, as that reporter at the Market Watch said in that audio clip, she said the one good news is yields on cash are starting to go up, as they are on bonds, short-term bonds, that is, or treasury bills, and also interest rate floaters. You know, this is the one that's really hard to believe. 2 years ago, the yield on a three-month Treasury bill actually got negative. Remember, that was about the peak when interest rates bottomed, the lowest point in interest rates in human history. Think about that, in 5,000 years. And when you were loaning money to governments, and it's still the case in Europe today, on short-term notes, you actually paid the government money to loan them money. So, however, that situation has changed. The Fed has raised interest rates now six times. And so when you look at the yield on treasuries, one of the hedges that we are using for our own clients, a three-month treasury bill, 1.9%, a six-month treasury bill, 2.1%, a one-year treasury bill, 2.3%. In one of my favorites, the two-year treasury note is over 2.5%, and a five-year treasury note is at almost 2.9%. So in the past, when bonds were working as a hedge, cash wasn't, because cash, the yield on cash was zero. If you were in a money market fund, you got nothing. And if you really wanted to go into the bond market, there wasn't anything there that was appetizing. Who wanted to tie up money for 10 years at 1.3% or 1.6%? Or imagine if you're an international institution or pension fund, who would want to loan money to a government and pay the government to loan them money, which is still the case in Europe with a lot of sovereign bonds.
Okay, and if we look at the banks, what about them? I mean, traditionally, they've been stingy in this area.
Well, they're having to compete for funds now. I mean, money markets are close to 2% now. So if you have your money in a money market fund, at least you're getting paid. One-year CDs nationally are around 2.3%. 2 years are at 2.65, only 10 basis points above a treasury note. And one of the reasons I like treasuries over banks, number one, you don't have to worry about the safety of deposits in the next downturn, as so many problems emerged in the banking industry in the last downturn. There's a second reason, and that's from a tax point of view. If you live in a state that has high taxes, like the state of California, New York, New Jersey, the interest you receive from your treasuries is exempt from state taxation. So the after-tax yield on a treasury is actually better than what you can get at a bank. Another area that I like, shorter term, is a hedge, is zero coupon treasuries. A zero coupon treasury is, think of savings bonds where you buy them at a discount and then they mature at face value. That's what a zero coupon bond is, except for we'll be using them with short duration. You don't really want to go out real long, because one of the problems that we could have is we could get into a treasury funding crisis in the next downturn when the deficits explode. They're already heading to $1 trillion. We could be looking at $2 trillion deficits in a major economic downturn. And then finally, another area that would benefit from this kind of environment, something that we've used very effectively for our clients, is floating rate bonds, which are tied to LIBOR. So just picture, every time the Fed raises interest rates a quarter of a point, the interest that you receive on those bonds gets adjusted upward by a quarter of a point. It's almost like when you have a variable rate mortgage, every time rates go up, you know what happens to your housing payment? Well, the nice thing about floating rate bonds is every time the Fed raises interest rates, the interest you receive as an investor goes up, and that's why they hold up their value in terms of a hedge. But right now, there are a number of reasons why, and you've heard it from our FS Inside interviews and many of the technicians and strategists we've had on the program. It's probably a time that you might want to start thinking about hedging.
And if we try to drag all of this together, it's probably time to start hiding your portfolio. Why is that? Well, number one, we know that 11 of the last 12 recessions and bear markets were preceded by Fed rate hikes, just like they're doing right now. Two, the Fed is also shrinking its balance sheet with quantitative tightening, and this has an effect of raising long-term interest rates. Three, the U.S. has the highest interest rates anywhere in the developed world. And four, the tighter yields in the U.S. strengthen the dollar, which could lead to your prediction, Jim, that the next crisis was going to be in the emerging world. And also, what's really important is that the reverse correlation between stocks and bonds is actually breaking down and isn't going to work anymore.
And I'd probably add two more to that, John, and that is the bond markets could become illiquid, just as passive indexing in the stock market has become popular, passive indexing in the bond market with ETFs has also become popular. And there's the illusion that these bond ETFs are liquid. I mean, you can sell them, trade them on a daily basis. However, a lot of the bonds within these ETFs could be illiquid if forced into a liquidation. And so it's giving the illusion there's a lot more liquidity. And don't forget, a lot of bonds as a result, or a bond dealers and traders, especially the big banks, have reduced their trading departments and aren't as active providing the liquidity they once did. And then I'd probably add another factor, which we touched upon with my interview with Don Cox this week, is the markets are basically run by robots. And we have no idea. There aren't humans making decisions anymore. It's computers. It's passive indexing. It isn't a portfolio manager or a human mind sitting there and say, do I really want to buy this company, Amazon, at 250 times earnings or Netflix at a high earnings? It's just when money comes into an index fund, it buys whatever is in the index. So you don't have human decision making anymore. It's all run robotically. And quite honestly, as Don Cox and I discussed in that interview, we don't know what the outcome's going to be when this thing unwinds. So what was once thought to be liquid may in the end not be liquid.
So in this segment, as we've demonstrated, it is time to hedge part of your portfolio before the storms arrive, because it's going to get more volatile, which means lots more up and down and a lot bumpier. So Jim, what are you doing?
I mean, we're using treasury bills, we're using treasury notes, we're using short-term laddered bonds, and we're using interest rate floaters. And the nice thing about that is as rates rise, the interest rate that you get goes up, but more importantly, you're protecting your principal. So, John, this is, like I said, the old correlation between bonds and stocks is no longer working, so you're going to have to start thinking outside the box in the next downturn.
Interest rates are rising, and the Fed intends to raise interest rates even further. As rates rise, the value of your bond funds will fall. Are you prepared for the next bond bear market? It has been almost 36 years since we've seen the last, and there's a high probability that another bear market in bonds has just begun. Long-term interest rates have been rising steadily since last fall. It's time to think about protecting capital. That's where Financial Sense Advisors can help you. Protect capital by designing a customized portfolio that can provide you with predictable income. Don't put your hard-earned wealth at risk. Call us today.
So give us a call at Financial Sense Advisors. As investment fiduciaries, we put your interest first. Let us help you design a portfolio that provides predictable income and protects your capital. Call now, toll free, 888-486-3939. That's 888-486-3939 to let us help you design a portfolio providing predictable income and protecting your capital. Securities offered through Financial Sense Securities Incorporated, member FINRA, SIPC. Advisory services offered through Financial Sense Advisors Incorporated, a registered investment advisor. You know, Financial Sense NewsHour listeners should remember that our premium members are able to hear the weekday Financial Sense NewsHour featuring interviews with top economic commentators and experts. If you're not a member, here's one of the interviews you missed this week.
We do see an inversion of the private yield curve before the onset of a recession, so it does do a good job of predicting recessions. But you actually see more inversions with the private yield curve than we do the public yield curve. And while you did have inversions that did not lead to recessions, they were very good predictors of financial instability. There were three cases in the 1990s where we saw this. We had an inversion in 1994, just before the Mexican peso crisis. We also had an inversion before the 97-98 Asian currency crisis and long-term capital management collapse. And then we saw a third inversion just before the 2001 recession. And so his point is that when we see a yield curve inversion in the private yield curve, what that is warning is financial trouble ahead and or a U.S. recession.
This is Chris Sheridan from FS Insider. And Jim, I want to note you had an excellent interview with Don Cox this week. It was really a wide-ranging interview discussing a number of different points. I want to ask you about some of the things that he brought up, because some of them I think are probably a little bit over some people's heads, and it's going to require a bit more explanation on your part, just because he's such a deep thinker. He's been in the industry for decades now, and you know, just the wealth of experience that he brings to the table. One thing that he mentioned that really caught my ear during the interviews, where he was talking about the futures curve with oil, and I know that you've been discussing oil quite a bit on the show. Maybe we should play that clip, and then if you wouldn't mind, Jim, tell us a little bit about what he said and what that meant to you.
The oil futures curve is no longer operating as a cushion, as it should, by showing people that the price in the future is higher because of these risks. Instead, it's showing the exact opposite because of all selling forward. So the result is that the futures curve operates to, in effect, create another oil crisis, because people looking at that say, oh, well, oil prices are due to come down. No.
What he was referring there, usually in the futures curve, the further out you go in time, you would normally see a higher price. So if you were, for example, going out on the stock market, if you were looking at where you thought the S&P would be a year from now or an interest rate, it would normally be higher. Markets operate in contango. When you look at the futures curve, it's going in the opposite direction. And a lot of that is being distorted by a lot of these shale producers and frackers who have had to go out and hedge their production. So as the price of oil has risen, a lot of these firms went out and they sold their production well into the future. And the result, Chris, is they brought a lot of supply into the markets, implying what Don was saying there. The futures market is implying that oil prices should be lower as you go further out, maybe a year from now or 2 years from now. And the problem is it's wreaking havoc with the profits of many of these companies. If you take a look at the top 20 frackers in the first quarter, only five of them had positive cash flow. In other words, out of the 20, 15 of them are losing money, spending almost $2 billion more than what they're taking in cash. So if you were looking at where the price of oil might be, if you were looking in the futures curve, that would tell you that in the future, a year or 2 years from now, the price of oil should be lower. When what Don was really arguing there, Chris, is that if you look at the fundamentals, I don't care if Chinese demand is growing, we're losing production out of Venezuela, we're going to be taking oil off the market with Iran, and even in the shale producing regions in Texas, there's a little over 200 million barrels of oil that will not reach the market because they've reached bottlenecks. In other words, we don't have the transportation and distribution system to get that oil to the market. So Don's reference there was the futures market isn't giving you a true picture of the fundamentals.
And so it sounds like a key takeaway from what he was saying is that it wouldn't be unexpected if oil prices were to climb higher, given, you know, what he's seeing with the futures curve, some of those bottlenecks that you just mentioned. And then as well, I mean, both you and him discussed a large number of geopolitical issues as well that are looming out in the horizon, whether or not we're talking about Venezuela, whether or not we're talking about things that are going on in the Middle East. So it sounds like he's bullish on oil.
He's very bullish on oil, bullish on commodities, as are others, and, you know, something that we'll be covering in detail in the big picture today. But if you look at commodity charts and you look at something like the CRB, Chris, the CRB index is the lowest it's been in nearly 40 years. And so when you look at something that is overpriced, as the markets are today, and you look at, let's say, commodities, something that is cheap, then he's very bullish on energy, as we are. And very bullish on commodities, especially gold and energy. I want to talk about some of the geopolitical risks that we covered that nobody's talking about.
So, Jim, as I mentioned, you and Don discussed a number of different geopolitical things, and I know that this is something that you have been researching and following quite closely as well. What were some of the major geopolitical risks on his radar that he's most concerned about?
Well, I mean, there's a number of them. What's going on in the Middle East right now with Iran? What's going on in Venezuela right now, which its economy and its production are literally collapsing? But it's also something, Chris, that we haven't really talked about in the last couple decades. And that is almost the rise of a new Cold War. There's a number of things that have happened. Last summer, Russia launched a new nuclear submarine that is undetectable. The George H. Bush Battle Carrier Group was tasked to find it, and they didn't. Recently, this week, CNN announced that Russians have announced a new ballistic missile delivery system that the U.S. has no defense against. So when you take these kind of things that you're seeing with China enlarging their blue water fleet, and then also in February, for the first time, the Pentagon and the U.S. budget changed, where the Pentagon is now changing its emphasis on military strategy from the war on terrorism to big power conflicts. And so these are things that you don't hear too much. Every once in a while, you'll see a buried headline, but underneath the surface, there is an arms race that is taking place with Russia and China, and now the U.S. is being forced to refocus where its military strategy is going to be aimed at and where the expenditures are going to be in the future as the Trump administration tries to rebuild U.S. nuclear forces to counteract what the Russians are doing. And nobody's talking about this.
So the last thing we have to discuss that really gets me excited is where he was talking about robotic markets. And this is something that I'm definitely most interested in, given my belief that artificial intelligence is going to continue working its way into not only the financial markets, but society as well. And so he talked about this from the standpoint of really just a lot of automation now taking place with trading, even with other areas and parts of the ETF universe, to the point where, you know, the human element has essentially been eliminated or reduced severely. And so let's play that clip where he talks about the downside of having a robotic market.
This could be the first example of what it's going to be like for the rest of the economy as technology advances. You know, for decades we've been saying, what happens if we have robots running companies? Okay? You know, that's been talked about and we've had various scholars looking at it. But we haven't had a test case yet where that happens. So it's not going to be in this case that the 500 stocks in the S&P had a huge percentage of them run totally by robots. It's going to be that the pricing and the valuing of what they do is being done in a robotic fashion, taking out the great safety mechanism, which is that you've got so many millions and millions of people making individual decisions about pricing. It reminds me of that first attempt at this, which was just when I came into the business in the early 70s, and using the power of a gigantic computer of the time, which had about the same strength as my laptop now, the forecast was made for economic growth, and this was a big thing that was announced, and then the Arabs invaded Israel, oil prices quadrupled, and we went into a recession, and so it blew it out. And they said, what went wrong? And they said, well, we had 200 factors that we used in our forecast, but since there have been no change in oil prices for decades, we didn't include oil prices as a factor. So what will the factor be that somebody said, well, isn't worth feeding into the system?
You know, that really reminds me, Chris, when we're talking about a lot of this automation, algo trading, and index investing that's dominating the market. And it's not just the stock market. It's moved over into the bond market, where a lot of these bond ETFs are being indexed to the bond market and being traded. And there's this illusion of liquidity when you're trading these ETFs, when the underlying bonds within the ETFs could actually be illiquid if forced in a major downdraft or liquidation. And this is what Don was referring to. And we saw a glimpse of this in the last week of January and the first week of February, where the markets were down about 12%. You had those reverse volatility funds that were essentially wiped out. They lost 80-90% in a single week. And this is something we have not experienced before. And so that's what Don is referring to there. In the next crisis, what is the one factor that nobody has priced in their econometric and market models? In my opinion, that's going to be liquidity.
Well, Jim, for any of our listeners that didn't get a chance to listen to that Don Cox interview, I do want to encourage them to do so. That was almost about a 40-minute conversation, and it was extremely wide-ranging. We only played just a glimpse of a couple clips that came from that interview. In addition to that, I do want to point out that we just spoke with Chris Poplava, our very own CIO here at Financial Sense Wealth Management this week, where he talked about a lot of the things that I know you're going to be discussing this weekend with corporate buybacks, emerging market troubles, and the like. So that was a really fascinating interview. And then also, we have spoken to a number of other big name guests on our program that you can access through FS Insider. So for any of you who are not signed up, feel free to do so. You can just go to our website and subscribe right from Financial Sense, or you can email me, CRIS, that's Chris with no H, at financialsense.com, and I can send you a link for a 30-day trial as well.
If you really had the chance, do listen to the interview with Don Cox. I always enjoy interviewing him. He's has a very great record in the markets. He's been in the markets more than 50 years, very prescient in many of his calls, including getting into bonds and zeros at the peak of interest rates at the beginning of the 1980s. He was also very influential in my own thinking at the end of the decade of the 90s of getting out of technology and moving into the commodity space in the beginning of the last decade. A lot of wisdom in this gentleman, and I think it comes out in that interview.
Everyone loves the stock market when it's going up. Making money in the markets, when you think about it, seems easy, which it is when you're in the middle of a bull market. But stocks, as you well know, don't always go up. And there are times when they can go down, in fact, go down a lot, which is why you need to have an investment strategy to help you navigate the good times along with the bad. Not everyone has an investment strategy, and quite honestly, many of you don't. That is where Financial Sense Advisors can help. We can put together an investment strategy to help you navigate those volatile investment markets in good times and bull markets and the bear markets that follow.
Call Financial Sense Advisors now and let us help you to make the change from just retiring to thriving in retirement. Call now, toll free, 888-486-3939. Again, that's 888-486-3939. Investment advisory services offered through Financial Sense Advisors Incorporated, a registered investment advisor. In case you didn't know it, the Financial Sense NewsHour is more than just our weekend show. We also have a weekday program featuring key economic experts, which is only available to our premium members. Here's part of one of the interviews from this last week.
It is pretty striking how poorly the consumer staple stocks have done. And I use the XLP ETF as a proxy, and that ETF is down more than 13% year-to-date, and by far the worst performer on a year-to-date basis. A lot of it makes sense. You know, those companies are struggling. Amazon's competing and eating away some of their business. And they're also viewed as a little bit of a bond proxy. It tend to be high dividend payers. We just talked about the 10-year at 307. And so some of those factors have been working against the sector. But on a rolling 90-day basis, that down 13% is the worst since the financial crisis. And then before that, you have to go back 15 years before you saw the staple sector down 13% over a 90-day period of time. So it's a two-sigma event, two-standard deviation event. And so what I've seen over time, in my experience, expectations are very low for the group. The stock, the group has been hit very hard in a group that tends to not be very volatile.
Welcome back to the Financial Sense NewsHour and the Big Picture with Jim Poplava and John Loeffler here with you. You know, it is no secret this year that commodities have been doing spectacularly well as an asset class, especially oil, which is up 75% since last summer. And oil stocks, which have been a laggard since January of this year, are some of the best performing sectors now within the S&P, taking up a leadership role in that area. The CERB index, which bottomed in February of 2016, and again in the summer of last year, has been rising steadily, even with the dollar's recent rise. So the question that we now mount here for this part of the program, are commodities a late cycle play or an undervalued asset?
You know, we did a show, I believe it was 2 or 3 weeks ago, we called it The Perfect Energy Storm. And it's amazing since that show, John, to see those storm fronts are now converging and getting even stronger. Now, when we did that show a couple weeks ago, we talked about $70 oil. Well, we've already broached the $70 level. We're at over $71 on this Friday, and it looks like oil at $80 is a distinct possibility if these storm fronts continue converging as they're doing now. But, you know, something that really struck me is if you look at anybody that has a chart software program, if you look at a chart of the CRB index, which hit a low in the summer of 2016 and then once again in the summer of 2017, we're at the lowest levels on commodities that we've seen in almost 40 years. And if you're listening to this broadcast and you have a chart program, just call up the CRB index and take a look at a monthly chart, and that'll take you back to roughly about 1980. Now, part of one of the reasons you're seeing the strength in the commodity index is the CRB index is heavily weighted towards oil. But my argument would be, if you're looking at the low price in commodities, oil prices were actually lower in the 80s and the 90s. There was one point in the 80s when oil got down below $10 a barrel. And likewise, in the 90s, remember 1998, when the price of oil got down to $10. And of course, what we saw in the next couple of years is the price went from $10 down to $35. And we had a recession, a Fed tightening cycle, and a bear market in stocks. But if you take a look at where we are now, these are some of the lowest prices that we've seen in an asset class in nearly four decades. So that sort of intrigues me. Now, we talked about the possibility when we did our Perfect Energy Storm show of $70 oil. And as I mentioned on this Friday, we're already here at $71.30. It's almost like every single week, either on the geopolitical front or on the fundamental front, for example, big story this week about frackers. Of the 20 top frackers for the first quarter, 15 of them actually had less money coming in than they were shelling out for oil. Only five of them had positive cash flow. There was another story that came out that what's going on in the shale industry in Texas is they're running into bottlenecks, not only on the labor front, but also on the transportation front. You got the oil, but they estimate that there'll be close to 240 or 260, I forget what the number is, 240 or 260 million barrels that will not be able to get to the market. Because you often hear about, well, if oil prices rise, U.S. shale production will increase and offset any demand or shortages elsewhere. Well, there's a number of reasons that may not happen.
And of course, the bear argument that we keep hearing, not the minimum argument, the one that bears make, is that U.S. production is going to offset any shortfall. But I take it you don't buy that.
No, I don't. As I just mentioned, there's a number of bottlenecks in the shale industry, from labor to pipelines. And as I mentioned, a lot of these frackers have been selling forward, which I discussed in my interview with Don Cox, and that's distorting the forward curve in the oil market. And it's also one of the reasons why these frackers weren't making as much money as the price of oil rose. For example, if oil was in the 40s and all of a sudden you started hedging at $50 a barrel, what do you do now when the price of oil is at $70 a barrel? You're still getting 50 because you sold your oil forward at $50 a barrel. This happened to a lot of the gold producers in the last decade before the bull market began as a result of almost a two-decade-long bear market. So many of the big, large producers like Barrick had sold much of their production forward. So as the price began to rise, those hedges were losing money, and it literally cost them billions of dollars to unwind. The same thing is happening in the oil industry with a lot of these companies selling their production forward. Now we're looking at prices that are much higher than where they sold their production, which is one reason why there's such a cash imbalance between what they're spending and what they're taking in. In fact, a good article in the Wall Street Journal talked about the net difference in cash for these top 20 frackers was almost $2 billion. So hedging played a big role, and it's underwhelming their cash generation. So shale producers failed to generate cash, even as many of the obstacles, let's say, to their profitability have been removed. A couple other things, too, I want to add is one of the big oil stories over the last 3 years, what did we talk about all the way up until about the last month or two, has been the oil glut. Well, guess what, folks? The oil glut is gone. According to an IEA report out this week, oil stocks have fallen to a three-year low. And not only on that, the IEA is warning because of lack of investment by Western oil companies and the national oil companies themselves, we could be facing oil shocks into the future because of lack of investment.
Yeah, and then there's the problem geopolitical, so to speak, with, well, notably here, Iran and Venezuela. We have this deal being withdrawn regarding the nuclear development going on in Iran. So Iranian oil could come off the market. Venezuela, its economy is collapsing. Its socialist experiment of the last 25 years hasn't worked. It's destroyed the country's economy. But also with that, oil production is collapsing.
Yeah, the current president appointed a general to run an oil company, and he's arresting executives, oil employees from Chevron, which has been one of the few large companies that have stayed with Venezuela. So between those two, if you take a look at maybe a 500,000 to 1 million barrels of oil of Iranian production taken off the market, it's anybody's guess in terms of what happens to Venezuela, because every time they come out with a forecast, their oil production drops even further. So they're down to 1.1 million barrels. It's hard to believe. A couple of years ago, they were producing 2.5 million barrels. But there's a bigger story here, John, that's not really covered, and that is Chinese oil demand and consumption. Oil imports in China are at record levels, and China is the world's largest importer of oil. Their oil imports were up over 7% in the first quarter, and it's one of the reasons why the IEA and the EIA are talking about oil consumption globally by the end of the year could hit 100 million barrels a day by year end. So I expect, even though we're at $70 oil right now, oil prices could head higher as these energy storms converge. So $80 is looking like a distinct possibility. And of course, as oil prices head higher, what does that mean as an investor? Well, if you're in the futures market, you're probably making money if you're leveraged. But also energy stocks should continue to lead. It's one segment of the market that is cheap, where even as an investor, if you want to play it on the conservative side, you can find dividend yields from 3 to 6%. One of the things that Kurt Wolf and I talked about was that in the energy market, investors have been demanding that oil companies become shareholder friendly, meaning return cash to investors either in stock buybacks or increasing dividends. And so as Kurt talked about in hour one, even some of the mid-tiered producers are now offering dividend yields that are close to 3%, which is close to what you'd get in a 10-year treasury bond. So if you look at what is cheap right now, it is commodities, which always performs well in the latter stages of a business cycle.
And if we allow that possibility, Jim, then what would you say your favorite areas are?
My favorite area in the commodity sector right now, at least in terms of valuations and also the fundamentals, are energy and gold. Gold is building a position that is a nice forming base that looks like it could break out. There are a number of factors fundamentally going for gold. Just take a look at what's going on with emerging market currencies. Take a look at what the U.S. will be facing in terms of its own deficits here in the next 12 to 15 months. And as I mentioned, when you look at a graph of the CRB, it is the lowest point it's been in nearly four decades, and we could be heading back to a stagflationary environment, maybe not like the 70s when you got inflation rates up to 14%, but nonetheless a stagflationary environment, maybe not as severe. So given that, John, those are two of my favorite investments right now.
So given these storm fronts that we anticipate are emerging or on their way and the need to hedge, what exactly do you like in terms of a portfolio construction?
For hedges, I love treasury bills and treasury notes. We like zero coupon bonds, definitely in favor of energy stocks. especially, you know, depending whether you're conservative or aggressive, you can find companies in each one of those spectrums to meet your demands. I love gold stocks. I think they're undervalued. In the bond front, we like short-term laddered bonds, and we like interest rate floaters that go up every time interest rates are raised by the Fed. I also like drug stocks. Many of these drug companies are offering very attractive dividends and very attractive valuations. In one sector I'm looking at, maybe not quite yet to get into, is the beaten-up consumer staples sector. It's one of the worst-performing sectors. You had two bad-performing sectors this year until recently. They were energy and they were consumer staples. Normally, as you get to the end of a business cycle, you see energy become the lead performer, and then you start to see consumer staples start to rise. When you start to see consumer staples start to rise, that's telling you you're probably closer to a recession. So if you look at the peak of how these market cycles play out, the first asset class to peak is bonds, which peaked in the summer of 2016. I mean, think about it. The 10-year Treasury note has gone from about 1.6 to close to 3.2, so it's almost doubled. The next area to peak will be the stock market, and then the last area to peak will be commodities. So right now, one of the best plays is commodities, but you also want to have hedges in right now because the markets, as a lot of the experts have been talking, and also even in our own strategy sessions for our own clients, we expect volatility to accelerate and pick up.
Jim, why is that important with volatility?
A couple of things. Number one, as the markets become more volatile, you're going to start to see a rise in credit spreads in bonds because it's telling the market players and investors that things are getting riskier, and especially with the Fed raising interest rates. The longer that this continues, watch what happens with consumers. They should start becoming more cautionary, and especially as the price of gasoline. I mean, here in California, we're already over $4 at the gasoline pump nationwide. We're heading to $3, so that's money out of the pocketbooks of consumers. Imagine what it's going to be like if we hit the $80 oil. So the more volatile the markets become, the more cautious investors become, the higher they require in terms of return, either lower PE ratios for stocks or higher yields on bonds. And so that's why volatility is important. But right now, we like the commodity sector. I think it's usually at the tail end of a business cycle. It is usually your best performing sector in the last peak. Number two, it's undervalued, probably the lowest level in 40 years. And number three, if you're taking a look at, along with that, hedging your portfolio, we like alternatives to the traditional 60-40% split that you've seen between bonds and stocks, because that's no longer working.
And as we round out the show today, Jim, if we're looking over the horizon, what would you say is coming towards us?
Well, coming up shortly will be the Fed meeting in next month, where it's widely expected they'll raise interest rates a quarter of a point. Right now, the economic indicators are showing consumer strength. But John, this week, mortgage rates hit the highest rate in 7 years, and we had some weak real estate reports. So I'm looking for a turn in the LEIs in the months ahead. And I'm also watching what's going on in the emerging markets as we're seeing the currencies of Argentina, Venezuela, Turkey collapse, and we're seeing a sell-off in emerging market debt and bonds, and that's where I think where the next epicenter of the crisis is going to be. So we're watching that rather closely. Those are some of the things we'll be watching going forward. In the meantime, on behalf of John Loeffler and myself, we'd like to thank you for joining us here on the Financial Sense News Hour. Until you and I talk again, we hope you have a pleasant weekend.
The Financial Sense News Hour is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the News Hour each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of the Financial Sense staff and do not take into account listener suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Financial Sense News Hour and its parent company shall not be liable for any financial losses that result from investing in any companies profiled on or advertised with Financial Sense. or arising out of the use of any material on the NewsHour. Be advised that you invest at your own risk.